What we're going to talk about tonight, and if you read the ads, you know that this is a seminar on abuse and abuse issues. And I've had some interesting responses from people over the last 3 years that I've done these kinds of seminars. Why do I need to go to a seminar on abuse? Some of them think, and then they tell me all about the abuse that they've experienced at someone else's hand. I find it quite interesting. But this is going to be a broader approach to abuse than probably you've been aware of in the past. It includes all of us. And you'll understand that before the evening is over. Tonight, what we're going to talk about is the origin of abuse and how it developed, where it began, how it began, the steps by which people became abusive. So tonight is kind of the bad news night, when you hear all the bad stuff about abuse. Tomorrow afternoon and tomorrow evening, we will talk about the good news. And the good news is really good news. I just want to assure you of that before we launch tonight, lest you get discouraged or depressed in looking at the bad news. So tomorrow will be the good news, and we have two sessions for the good news, which should tell you that the good news far outweighs the bad news. That is, there's more good news than there is bad news in terms of content. This is the product of a journey I have taken for the last 3 to 5 years. I personally have been a victim of abuse, ongoing, relentless, incurable. Some abuses in life are not so easy to walk away from. I am not married, so it's not a spouse. But it's something that happened in my life that I would fain have done without, but as a result, I'm forced to deal with on an almost daily basis. It's also the product of a journey I've taken theologically. I teach college students. I teach ethics and theology to them. And one of the things that really dawned on me after a few years of teaching full-time was that it seemed that my students could get the theory at least long enough to pass the exam, but it did nothing for their lives. It did nothing to change their lives. They went out of there the same people, out of my classes the same people as they came in. Now, in an academic setting, of course, like a college level, maybe I'm expecting too much. Maybe all I'm there to do is teach information. But I was troubled by that. I was also troubled by students who came to me telling me about the Christian homes they came from and the parental abuse they had suffered. And I knew some of their parents. That was the bad thing. Some of their parents were my friends. And to hear these terrible stories, these horror stories, literally, of abuse, just really created some problems in my mind, and I began to try to rethink what is wrong with my presentation of truth? Why doesn't it change people? Why? What is it? How could a person hold the same beliefs that I hold about God and how, the kind of person he is, and then turn around and abuse their children? And I, in my search for answers, I came to realize that most of our theology, most of our understanding of God, most of our religious experience is what I would call left brain. Now, I don't know if you're aware of the anatomy of the brain. This is something I'm doing more and more, especially in my ethics class. I call it the anatomy of morality because it helps to know where we do morality in our brains. We have frontal lobes, two frontal lobes, the left and the right frontal lobe. The left brain is where we do our rational thinking. It's where we learn facts. It's where we deal with information. The right brain is the creative, emotional side of the human being. Most of us are predominantly left brain or right brain. Our society is predominantly left brain. In terms of education, in terms of how we tend to make information known, we are mostly left brain. We try to make left-brain people out of all of our students from the lower grades on up. We tend to ignore the creative aspect, the emotional aspect, for the sake of the rational, thinking, logical, and factual information. So what happens then is that when I go into a religion class, I'm teaching to the left brain. I'm telling them the facts, I'm telling them the information, I'm saying this is what you should believe about God. And the result is that they get it cognitively, they can write it on exams, but until it gets to both sides of the brain equally, There's no change in the life. You see, the emotional fight isn't just feelings. Feelings, the really strong center of feelings is the midbrain, where the fight and flight center is. That's the part of the brain that enables us to run away when we're in danger, that gives us fear when we're in danger, or that produces anger. And the midbrain response actually happens because the frontal lobes have shut down and the blood vessels have actually constricted there so that we're not thinking rationally anymore. Have you ever talked to somebody who was angry? Really angry? Could you reason with them? No. You can't reason with an angry person. Why? Because you can't access their frontal lobes. Their frontal lobes are completely shut down. So as I thought about all of this, I decided that my theology had to be experiential. That's the right side of things. The left side is learning it in a rational, organized, logical, coherent, informational manner. The facts. The right brain is experiencing it. And there are things that we can only learn by experience. Now, I had a lot of help in making the shift theologically. This is a major shift. I'm still making it. I'm still in a process of attempting to... By the way, I haven't left the left brain. I'm trying to get both brains in balance here. But in the process, I've had a lot of help. And I'll be mentioning those helps from time to time. One of my students, who was an older woman, older than I, who had experienced life at its worst, wrote a beautiful paper in reaction to a book and explained some things about love that I had never understood before and which opened a whole new window of understanding. And I'll be sharing that probably not so much tonight, but tomorrow. I had some help from colleagues. I had some help from life experiences. When I was working on my doctoral program, I had a week between the written exams that I had to do and the oral examination. And I was burned out. I knew I wouldn't learn any more by studying any harder. And so I had this week with nothing to do. What am I going to do besides pace the floor and hope I pass? Well, I decided to go down to the Christian bookstore nearest me and find some books that were storybooks, light reading, and that were on sale, hopefully. I wouldn't have to spend too much money. So I went to the sale shelf, and sure enough, here were all these storybooks, and I bought them, something like five of them, brought them home, and spent the whole week with these books. They were all about stories of people who had been abused. I didn't know how I'd managed this. And I spent a whole week reading about abused victims. And I thought, well, this is really funny. And it really wasn't funny. It was very sad. I cried my way through all the books because they were all sad stories at certain points. All of them eventually crawled out of the abuse cycle and got victory. And so I learned a little bit from their experience. But I wondered why. Well, that summer, I began studying something that I needed to study for a Bible class I was teaching. And I came to a very profound conclusion. At least for me, it seemed profound. And that is that sin is abuse. And that we are all caught up in the cycle of abuse. And when you enlarge the picture like that, suddenly you begin to see life in a new dimension. So what I want to talk about tonight is, where did abuse begin? Where did the abuse cycle begin? How did we get in it? And by the process of doing that, it's going to become clearer what we experience that we don't enjoy in life. It's going to become clearer to us experientially what happens around us. So I'd like you to turn to page 1 of your handout. It's called The Anatomy of a Fall. And I'm sure that most of you did not bring your Bibles, so I'm going to refer you to two passages that this primarily takes off from in the Bible. And one is Ezekiel 28 about the king of Tyre. And the other is Isaiah 14, the king of Babylon. Now, these two figures, if you read those two chapters very carefully, it becomes very clear that it's more than just an ordinary king it's talking about. And there are a number of scholars who feel that this figure really has supernatural qualities. Christians in older eras believed that these two chapters were talking about the same person that we call Satan today, and who was once a beautiful, bright, shining cherub in the presence of God, and who fell and defected against God. That tends not to be held by so many today, but I still find credibility for it. If nothing else, this figure is kind of the personification of how evil begins. So we're going to look at it in that way. And what you have in front of you, this anatomy of a foal, is what I believe is a step-by-step process by which this figure became evil. This would be like the original prototype of how a person fell from perfection to being evil. Now, the standard answer we give to how did sin begin is it began with pride. So don't you dare get proud. You ever tried them? I'll tell you a funny little story on me. And I was about 3 years old. My mother was looking around. I hope she doesn't mind my telling this. But my mother was looking around one evening for someone to help her set the table for supper. I had never done that before. I was pint-sized every inch of my life, every slow-crawling inch of my life. And the table was above my head. But nobody responded. Nobody seemed to want to help Mom set the table for supper, so I offered my services. And she looked at me and said, "Are you sure you can?" "Oh, yes, Mommy." So she decided to let me, against, I think, her better judgment, which turned out to be very accurate. She handed me the first bowl, and she said, "Now you walk over to the table," and she told me right where to put it, and I walked over to the table, and I remember putting it on the table. And then I went and got the other bowl, and I went and put it on the table on the other spot. And by the third bowl, I was feeling pretty pleased with myself. Look at me. I'm doing this all by myself. And as I walked toward the table, thinking I had a good grip on that bowl, it all of a sudden descended out of my hands on the floor and broke into pieces. And my world shattered. I was so upset. I remember bursting into tears. "I didn't mean to, Mommy." And she was very calm about it, very wonderful about it, and just picked up the pieces and we went on. But I remember supper going down very hard past a lump in my throat that night, because I couldn't figure out how I dropped that bowl. So I thought about it for weeks. I was always a thinker. And I had to understand everything as a child. So I thought about it for weeks. And as I analyzed and over how it happened, I came to a conclusion. It was right at the moment when I was thinking about how good I was doing that I dropped that bowl. Aha! It was pride, you see. So I went through the rest of my life, practically, trying very hard not to think I would ever do anything successful. Because that had to be pride, you see. And so I had to demean myself, humble myself, walk around like feeling like a little worm in order to, what? Keep from dropping bowls and breaking them. Unfortunately, that has been kind of the attitude we've had toward pride. That pride is that thinking well about yourself, or thinking that you have any value, or thinking that you can do anything. So we've tended to go for the opposite. Try to not think we can do so well, and you know, somebody compliments us, "Oh, well, you know, I had to be a miracle that I did that, because, etc." And we tend to go through life like that, which cripples us terribly from what God would have us do. That's the side of low self-esteem. You see, if you look at this chart here, we have pride on the left and low self-esteem on the right. Now, the left side is the side of the abuser. The right side is the side of the victim. That's another way to look at that. A person who's very proud and arrogant tends to demean other people and thus creates victims. And so that's what these two sides are about. The abuser on the one hand creates the victim on the other. If you go to Isaiah 14, pride is described there. "You said in your heart, 'I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit in the mount of assembly on the heights of home. I will ascend to the tops of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High.'" This I will. I'm big shot. I'm really somebody. And I'm going to be even a greater somebody. So you have this pride. I would like to redefine what pride is. Pride is the misvalue of a person. And thus, pride is not only thinking more highly of myself than I am, it's thinking less highly of myself than I am. Pride is as much low self-esteem as it is too high a self-esteem. So where do we find the balance in the middle? Well, most of us try to fix ourselves this way. We get a little too proud and we stumble and fall. You've had that experience? You know, you get a little too caught up in self-exaltation and all of a sudden, boom, down you go. And you're like, "Oh, that hurt." And you analyze it, oh, I got too proud. Okay, so the next time, oh, I was really bad. I didn't do anything. Oh, don't give me any credit. No. So we self-abnegate. We go into self-abnegation, humbling ourselves, making ourselves little and small to counteract our pride. What we've done is gone to low esteem to offset our pride. So then we get feeling really like a worm, and we go groveling around before God. And God says, this poor person, they need a little bit of an uplift. They need to know they're worth something. They need to know they can do something. So he gives us a moment of success. And we've been so low and downtrodden so long that when we have that moment of success, we go, oh, yes, I'm really somebody. And we jump back into a higher state of pride than we had before. And then we fall. And so we run back to our low self-esteem and we hug it tight and, oh, I'm just really poor. And until we have the next success. And so we go back and forth, and that's how we try to keep balance. All we're doing is running back and forth on the pendulum of pride. It's what I have come to call the bipolar Christian experience. It is truly how it works. We go higher and lower and higher and lower. I've seen people like that. They're miserable. So what's the solution? The solution is to realize that pride isn't whether I'm bad or whether I'm too good. The pride has to do with even thinking that my worth is in what I earn, what I succeed in, what degrees I get. It amuses me. I have a PhD now. I got it finally after 15 years of hard labor in a concentration camp called a doctorate. And it amuses me because suddenly to some people I'm a little more valuable than I was before. I mean, nothing's changed. I just got my PhD, right? But to some people that means I'm more valuable. I'm worth more now. That's nonsense. But see, that's where pride gets us. Pride is thinking that I am worth what I earn, what money I make, how hard I've labored, what degrees I have, what my social status is, what my titles are, how well I've done with my kids. And you can go right down the list. Everything that's the American way is pride. Because we have come to value ourselves for all the faults and wrong things. And that leads us to say, he's richer, I'm poorer. She's smarter, I'm dumber. She's better, I'm worse. He's greater, I'm lesser. Those are what I call air words. Air words are the comparatives. You studied English class, English grammar once upon a time, and you learned about comparatives. Pride is comparative thinking. It's saying, I am this or that. It's either direction, better, worse, richer, poorer, stronger, weaker, etc. It's all of those. So how do we get off of that? Well, I have a question for you tonight. What is it that makes you valuable? What is it that gives you worth? Anybody want to venture a guess? I'm a teacher at heart. I'm not a preacher. What makes us valuable? What gives us worth?
Well, we're in the church, we feel like I'm being valued by God. This is what it is.
Okay, good, good. Why does God value us?
Because he loves us so much.
Why does he love us?
He created us.
He created us. Good. That's precisely the answer I was fishing for. And according to the Bible, we were created in the image of God. Period. That's what makes us valuable. Period. That means I'm just as valuable as you are. Does that make sense? It means it doesn't matter whether I get a PhD or own a $1 million home or live in a hut. I'm equally valuable to God. So that nothing I do, that I earn, that I gain, that I achieve in any way changes my basic worth or value. It doesn't add to it. It doesn't decrease it. My basic worth stays the same. And once we get a handle on that, it changes everything. Suddenly it doesn't matter whether you won the race or not, and everybody else lost. That's not an issue. What matters is that we are all equally valuable to God. Now, when this being that Isaiah and Ezekiel talks about began his trajectory, he began it in this attempt to be better, greater, superior, stronger, more powerful than everybody else. That's where he began. And correspondingly, by doing that, he pushed everybody else below him down into low self-esteem. You're not as great as I am. You're not as big as I am. The problem is that in heaven, nothing was run that way. Nobody thought in those terms before. They never thought in terms of better, greater, stronger, richer, poorer, like we are so accustomed to today. So, with that basic beginning into a completely new thinking process about himself, he moved to the next stage. And the next stage is a little harder to explain. I call it externalism. This comes from Ezekiel 28. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. It ties together with the line above. Your heart grew haughty because of your beauty, and you corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your bright splendor. Is it wrong to stand in front of the mirror and ask yourself if you're beautiful? I think most of us don't do it very much. But is it wrong? Is it wrong to love beauty? Didn't God create it all around us? In fact, originally it was much more beautiful than we see now. So there's nothing wrong with beauty. So what was so bad about him corrupting his wisdom for the sake of his splendor? And why would his heart get haughty because of his beauty? Well, you all heard the phrase, beauty is skin deep. It's only the surface. It's what I call external. The external is what we do when we lack the internal. Have you ever let your house just really go and then companies suddenly announced they were coming? What did you do? It happens in my department. Once a year we have some dignitaries come to interview our students. And we're very thankful we have closets. Because most of us are so busy, we just don't have time to keep everything in order. So into the closets, everything goes. Then we shut the door, and it looks all nice and beautiful. That's externalism. That's what Jesus described as washing the outside of the cup. You remember he said if we wash the inside of the cup, the whole cup will be clean? Would you like to drink out of a cup that was only washed on the outside? Most of us wouldn't. That's externalism. There's another way of looking at it. What the king of Tyre did was to exchange the important and importance, his external looks for his internal worth. That is, it came to him to be more important to how he looked than how he thought in his mind. So he corrupted his wisdom for the sake of his splendor. That is, his external ability became more important than his internal ability. Now, let me word that a little differently. Externalism works like this. I try to control my environment, including everybody in it, because I'm out of control inside. Have you ever known that process? That's the process of abuse. If I'm an externalistic person, I try to control my external environment, including other people in it, because internally I'm out of control. I can't control myself. It's that kind of exchange. So I'm worried more about what my neighbor does and thinks than about what I do and think. And I go after my neighbor or my friend or my spouse or my children or anybody else in my wake because internally I'm out of control. And I may not even be aware of that. It's a shift from the internalization of how things really work to attempting to arbitrarily make everybody fit into my scope and in my area of control. This can happen in the workplace, and I've been in work situations where it was ongoing. I've had bosses, for example, who just about wanted to control my daily life, what I did after hours as well as what I did during hours, or who were constantly keeping me under surveillance, shadowing me, making sure I did my work just right. And the truth is that there was a certain internal sense of loss with that person. You go and talk to them, and internally they're nothing. They don't have any sense of boundaries, any sense of self-respect, any sense of personhood and who they really are. There's another way of looking at externalism. Externalism versus internalism is the difference between Yosemite National Park and Disneyland. Now, this is easy to talk about in this environment. How many of you prefer Disneyland to Yosemite Park? No takers. I'm with you. But I know some people who probably prefer Disneyland to Yosemite National Park. Externalism is an artificial reality. It is seeing the artificial, the not real, as more significant and more real than the real, the natural, what really is and how things really work. We'll probably be coming back to that, this whole concept of externalism. I know it's a little bit new and maybe a little hard to grasp. When I look at the victim falls prey to artificiality. And where this really shows up is in young women, and I suspect some young men as well, but in young women who fret more about their outward appearance and spend more time on it than they do cultivating their internal appearance or their internal thinking and wisdom. The next step, once you start changing your environment from internal to external, you then begin to want supremacy. I want to move back a little bit to externalism, and I think I can give you a very clear picture of what it is. If we look at page 6, this is how it worked out in society. This is the societal page, and I have two models. One is God's original plan, that's to the left. The other is the way we did it, the way human beings invented these things. And if you look under economy, number one, if you can think to a time in our world when there were no kings, only people, a time when there were basically people living off the land, like the American Indian, they hunted, they gathered, and society was interdependent on one another. Everybody was valuable integrally because they were necessary for the maintenance of the society. So everybody was valued and protected. And they all worked to protect one another. Nobody lived for themselves. They couldn't and survive. Some people in Mesopotamia got an unusual notion. They came to believe that they could create more wealth, get bigger, better, stronger, if they did cultivation and agriculture. And so they began to develop communities for the sake of doing agriculture. Now, we see nothing wrong with agriculture. In fact, agriculture is a whole heap better than living in cities and other things. But nevertheless, it was a move in the direction of a city. And with economics, with the development of economics, they began to think not in terms of giving to someone in need, but in terms of getting from someone. So they began to bargain. I need a sheep. Oh, you do? Well, I have a donkey here. How many sheep will you give me for it? And they began to make exchanges. You need a sheep. I'll give you 2 sheep if you'll give me your ass, because I need your ass. You can see how this coveting your neighbor's things could easily fall into this. And they began to do exchanges. And then they began to develop this thing called money. And with the development of money, they developed a whole artificial reality. For example, in the bargaining stage, it was like this. I sold my ass to you for 2 sheep, but I want it back, and I'll give you 3 sheep for it. We call that inflation. Says who? Does a donkey equal 3 sheep? That's nonsense. That's not reality. But that's the direction we took. And with economics, as a result of that, we created our own virtual reality. To the point where, in the American state of things, we don't even have an economic base anymore. We're on shifting sand. Because the hard currency just isn't there anymore. It hasn't been for years. We gave it all away or used it all up, and here we are, working with paper, basically, making fake transactions. And with that whole kind of thinking, we developed an externalistic society. And our whole value system changed dramatically. Because ultimately, with economics, people became valued according to their economic worth. And the end result of that is called slavery, where you can actually own a human being like you would a dog or a calf or an ox or an ass. Slavery was invented in Mesopotamia out of the whole economic process. So going back to page one, once you start doing that comparison, start thinking in terms of better, worse, richer, poorer, stronger, weaker, once you start making those error words a part of your vocabulary, we fall prey to supremacy. Somebody wants to be the best, the biggest, the strongest, worth the most. Or to put it like the king of Tyre, or I should say the king of Babylon does, I will lift my throne above the stars of God. I'll get the biggest of all. You see, God never intended that one person rule over another. God's original plan for creation was non-hierarchical. That didn't mean there was no supreme being who is better and bigger than all of us. But that better and bigger did not mean the same thing it means to us now. And we'll get into that tomorrow when we talk about solutions to abuse. So once we had someone wanting to rule over other people, and that was a slow development. Society was really early on very resistant to that notion. But once it did develop, then you had this ability to control other people, to put fear into them. And that's the next natural step, control. And so the king of Babylon says, I will preside on the Mount of Assembly in the remote places of the north. I will take over. I will be king. And you will be my subjects. And you will obey me. That changes the meaning of obedience dramatically from what God originally intended it to be. And once we start trying to control other people with supremacy, the next thing we have to resort to in order to maintain our control of people is to misrepresent the truth. It's no accident that Satan is called the great deceiver of the whole world. The one who is the father of lies, as Jesus depicted him. You see, it's my belief that Satan is the supreme abuser of us all. And I don't know if you've ever had to work for someone who's a classic abuser, but their classic way of abusing people is to never tell the truth. Keep them always puzzled because you change your tune every time you turn around. I've been in situations like that. They're no fun. Because a person who does that can never be really caught because he always has a different reason the next time. It becomes a web of lies. From that, the next step in the trajectory of abuse is raw power. We want power, supreme power. I have two examples of that from the Bible. The king of Babylon, I will ascend over the heights of the clouds. And who is equal to the beast and who can conquer it? Or who can make war against it? The beast in Revelation, you remember, is a very ferocious creature. Very, very opposite to the lamb, which it contrasts. And the idea is this beast is so powerful that nobody can conquer it. Nobody can make war against it. And finally, if all else fails, the resort to violence. Once a person resorts to violence, the cycle of abuse, pretty much, the trajectory is complete. Now, I have one more step on here, imaging. Society has had unique ways of institutionalizing abuse. And that's the imaging process. Take a milder form of abuse and it becomes, this is the way we do things. It becomes the institution. An example is policy. Policy can be very abusive. And when policy becomes dominant, and it's an abusive policy, we have imaging going on. Because it becomes the status quo. It's the way we do things. It's according to our rules of governance. The problem with that is that those rules change from whoever's in control to whoever's in control. From time period to time period. Now, of course, I've given you the alternate side, the side of the victim. Pride, low self-esteem, externalism, artificiality, supremacy to oppression. The victim becomes oppressed by a person who is dominant and gains supremacy over them. A person who is controlling produces a person who is dependent. A person who misrepresents creates a person who is deceived. And when a person has a lot of power, submission seems to be the only way to go. When there is violence, there is complete victimization. And when it becomes institutionalized, everybody lines up and goes along with the system because they don't want to lose their jobs, or because they don't want to lose their status quo, or because they don't want to be out of sorts with other people. It's all the process of abuse. I believe that this began in heaven. I believe that that's how Satan became Satan. In Hebrew, the term Satan, which is a title, by the way, it's not a name, the term Satan means either accuser or adversary. One could say abuser by extension, because a person who is both accusing and adversarial is abusive. And I believe this is the step-by-step progression of he took that led him to become an abuser. And what we want to look at next, page 2, is how he got Adam and Eve through the serpent to believing his abusive tactics. Now, this is going to be a little confusing unless I set the stage for it. Eve meets the serpent at the tree of knowledge of good and evil. The serpent abuses her, but tries to make her think that it's really God who is abusing her. You know, I have been a victim of abuse in situations where the abuser very artfully tried to make his victims seem to be the abusers. In fact, behavioral scientists tell us that the common hallmark of abusers is that they see themselves as victims and try to create a poor me kind of image in their victimization. That's what the serpent did. That's what Satan did through the serpent. He tried to abuse Adam and Eve, and he did so very successfully. But while he did it, he was portraying God to be the abuser. And that is so key to our understanding where we all are and how we got here. So I'd like to take a step by step through this. He started out with a word that's not usually translated unless it's translated by indeed. It's a word that, if I were to say it in Hebrew, it's simply af. And you wouldn't know what af means. Well, af, it means nose, it means anger, it means a number of different things. Most Hebrew words have more than one meaning. And af is no exception. When it's used at the beginning of a sentence, it actually means this. So it's very hard to translate. I mean, what are you going to say? So if I'm translating indeed, it's sort of like, oh yeah. It could even be a snort. It has to do with scorn. So it's sort of like, oh yeah, God said. What immediately comes to your mind? Well, imagine when you were in elementary school and the teacher told you explicitly you were not to do something. Pass notes back and forth. Okay, good illustration. Or chew gum. That was the old-fashioned one. You were in elementary school, and your teacher told you not to do that, and a little kid reached over and said, oh yeah, you think she really meant that? What immediately happens in your mind? Don't take that seriously. But what picture was your classmate portraying to you about your teacher? She didn't really mean it? What does that imply about her character?
She didn't have backbone.
She didn't have backbone enough to enforce it? She wasn't clear, maybe, about what she meant?
Might overlook it?
What does it suggest? Maybe we should go back to Genesis 2 and ask some questions about it, because we bring our certain calculated biases to these passages. You remember when God created Adam and Eve, it says, "And the Lord God commanded the man, 'You may freely eat of every tree of the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you shall die.'" Now, you're Adam and Eve. God has just said this to you. What goes through your mind? Do you know what die means? Had anybody ever died before? Ever tried to tell a three-year-old, if you run in front of the car, you're going to die? Three-year-old understand you? No. Not unless they've witnessed death, which is very horrible for the first time anybody ever witnesses it. That's the dilemma God is faced with. Now, I have a question for you about this. Was this a command? Did God lay down the law? This is my new commandment, and you are not to eat of this tree.
No, he wanted us to have free will, so he led us to be, let there be a choice there, right?
Yeah, he let us have a choice, or maybe he wasn't laying down a law. What would be an alternative then for this?
Advice that you better he did.
Advice, better that you did. Warning, maybe? Your toddler is heading for the fireplace and reaches his little hand past the grate and gets closer. You suddenly turn into a legislator, right? Johnny, don't go near the fire. Is that a command or a warning? It's a warning. You see, the problem is that once Satan questions this command, and in a sense it is a command, but in a sense it's not a kind of command like we have commandments later on in the Bible. It's more of, if we picture it in a family setting, God is issuing a warning about some very real things that are going to happen. You see, I don't think God originally planned that the tree of knowledge of good and evil be called the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Why would you have the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil? That's like having apples and oranges or something. Doesn't make any sense. But it would make sense if God had the tree of life and the tree of death. But I think when Satan inhabited that tree and took it over, he didn't like that title, death. That's too blatant for what I want to do. That misrepresents me. So he changed it to the tree of knowledge of good and evil. But it really was the tree of death. When God put those two trees in the garden, he wanted it very clear in Adam and Eve's mind that there would be dreadful consequences if they ate that fruit. Satan takes that and twists it. It's just a command, and it's an arbitrary command. It could be changed. It could mean something else. It may not be clear. And once you go down that route, everything changes. You shall not eat. As God said, you shall not eat. The idea being the issue is authority. Now, in the ancient Near East, a person had authority if they could order people about. Simply tell them to do things and they would do it. And it was understood that God had the same authority. He commanded the sun to shine and it shone. He commanded the trees to leaf out and they leafed out. He commanded the grass to sprout up and it sprouted up. He commanded all of the things in creation, and they did obey him. Therefore, he could just command humans, and that was it.
For side two, please turn the tape directly over without rewinding.
And it was understood that God had the same authority. He commanded the sun to shine, and it shone. He commanded the trees to leaf out, and they leafed out. He commanded the grass to sprout up, and it sprouted up. He commanded all of the things in creation, and they did obey him. Therefore, he could just command humans, and that was it. The problem is that we're not blades of grass. We have, as was stated here, freedom of choice. We have ability to think to create and to do. We have reasoning powers. And the idea that we can simply be commanded about is to suggest that we don't have frontal lobes. After all we have is a midbrain response, because that's all the animal world has. Called instinct. But it's really equivalent to our midbrain. But God gave us reasoning powers, and He does not bypass those reasoning powers. So I think the Bible probably gives us a very short end of the picture. God is really saying a lot more to Adam and Eve about what that command meant. In the serpent's words, it becomes authority-based. He's just trying to flaunt his authority. He's just trying to lord it over you. He doesn't care about you, and that becomes very clear in the next words. Has God said, you shall not eat of any tree in the garden? Did God say that? Let's put it in a modern setting. You tell Sally that she is not to take a cookie out of the cookie jar. Especially when her little friend Patty is over to play with her. So Patty and Sally are playing happily in the living room, and Patty sees the cookies in the cookie jar. And she says, ooh, cookies, can I have one? And Sally says, no. Oh, has your mom said you can't eat anything in the kitchen? You're listening in the back. Wait a minute. That's not what I said. I simply said you can't eat the cookie. But do you see what happens? The serpent is now resorting to deception. Very slightly. He is suggesting that God not only is doing this to lord it over His creatures, but He's very selfish and arbitrary and harsh about it. He's not letting them eat of anything. Now, He doesn't do that in a statement, because He would be easily refuted. He does that in a question. Has God said, you shall not eat of any fruit which is in the garden, of any tree? And Eve, by answering, steps right into His manipulative designs. Let me tell you something about abusers. If you're ever in the presence of one and you find it's a one-way street, ever been in the presence of someone for whom it was a one-way street, you had to think like they did, and it wasn't something they told you. It was just something that happened as a result of talking to them. I know there's a few people like that in this world. There's few people that abusive. But I have actually had the experience of being in the presence of someone who was so abusive that I could not think my own thoughts or respond to him with my own words. And when you're in that situation, you don't really want to talk to them. It's dangerous. That's why Eve really shouldn't have been talking to the serpent. She shouldn't have tried to respond to him. Because she was led down a one-way street. Then there were no off-ramps, no ways to turn around and go back. She was in his path. And she would be manipulated to say what he wanted her to say. And so she said, no, God didn't tell us we couldn't eat of any tree. Only this one tree. He said, neither should we touch it, lest we die. Now, in Genesis 2, does God say, neither shall you touch it? It's absent. It's totally absent. So Eve actually walks right into the path of the serpent and adds the words, neither shall you touch it. What is she doing already? She's setting herself up. She's moving in the direction of externalism. Because now the problem is the fruit. Not everything else around it. Not talking to the serpent. Not indulging in his ideas. But it's the fruit itself that is the problem. Have you ever wondered what God put in that tree of knowledge of good and evil? Apples? Reminds me of when I taught overseas. My poor students couldn't do English very well. And when I asked them to write about this whole story, one of my students informed me that Adam and Eve ate the apple tree, and that's what got them into trouble. But you know, we have something to think like that. The sin was eating the apple. And we still talk about it, don't we? We call it biting the apple. And there's a whole company out there that's capitalized on that greatly. Made a lot of money off of that slogan. So we have two externalized things. And then she adds one more touch that God didn't say. God said, if you eat of it, in the day that you eat of it, you will surely die. Cause, effect. Eve said, lest you die. Now what has happened? She's walked right into the serpent's path, when God, what God said was simply cause and effect, now becomes, moves from a warning to a command to a threat that may or may not be fulfilled. And then the serpent says, with kind of a snort, "You shall not surely die." Well, there's ways you can go on that. The fruit won't hurt you. You can't die. If you are to die, it will be by execution. God can't kill you. He lacks the power. God is a liar. Where does that lead us? That God is arbitrary, selfish, commanding, manipulating, and deceptive. He's an abuser. That's the picture the serpent is painting to Eve, is that God is an abuser. And then he goes on, God knows in the day that you eat it. You see, he's holding back the truth and controlling you with deception. He knows something would be good for you, but he's withholding it from you. Your eyes will be opened, and this external substance, this fruit, has the power to make you wise. How many people in our world buy into that? This drug has power to give you enlightenment. This drug has power to make you happy. This drug, our whole world is full of that. Your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, equal to God. Power, knowledge, you'll be like God. The word like means here to resemble. Very clever of the serpent. Doesn't say you will be God, just you'll resemble God. Well, there's some truth to that, isn't it? If you become, we are to resemble God, aren't we? But the problem is, this fruit is going to do that for you. And the issues are external objects, power, knowledge, and once you obtain these, you will become a supernatural and transcendent being. Why would you want to be your own creator? If you thought your creator was an abusive person, would you not want power equal to him so you could keep him off your back? See, there's a lot of things going on in here, and we have the short story. We have the Reader's Digest version of what happened. There may have been much more conversation. What we have is the nutshell. So we have to understand what is really going on and the power that the serpent is playing over Eve. And then he says, you will be like God's knowing good and evil. Do you know the most destructive kind of abuse is not complete abuse? Let me give you an example. There was a book, and I don't know if you've ever read it, called A Child Called It. Dave Peltzer wrote it. And he lives up in Santa Rosa. That's one of the most horrible stories you could ever read. It's the third worst child abuse case in California. It happened in the 70s before the laws were so strict. And Dave went through everything imaginable. His mother starved him constantly to the point where he began stealing lunches at school. She locked him in the bathroom with chlorine gas. The only way he could stay alive was to breathe over the air vents in the furnace. She stabbed him so badly that, and then wouldn't take him to the hospital because she was afraid of getting caught. And so he had to bandage his own wounds. He had to clean it out with hydrogen peroxide because he got a terrible infection, nearly died. She made him sleep out in the garage with inadequate covering. She made him lie in a bathtub of cool water on a cold winter day in Daly City, California. Just on and on. Horrendous abuse. She called him It. That's where he got the title for his book. But she had once been very good. When he was six, up until he was 6 years old, she was a wonderful mom. It was like one day she snapped, and from then on he became her victim. I believe it was because she was so bad, and because he once had a different mom to gauge the horrors of what he experienced against her, that he was able to survive. What is most trying, and this is normal in abuse, in severe cases of abuse, what is most trying is a parent who beats his child one day severely, and the next day brings home candy. Try to make up for a beating the day before because he feels so bad. That's mixing good and evil. And what it does is confuse the child because the child thinks, oh, He's so nice to me today. How could he ever be so bad? And you see what happens? He tries to rationalize the badness as it deepens, because usually in abuse cases, the trajectory gets worse and worse. It doesn't stand still. It isn't consistent. And so a child faced with that begins to think that his dad has to be right and feels guilty for ever thinking that he's not. That's the worst kind of abuse, because it becomes fast institutionalized. Well, by saying that you will become like God, knowing good and evil, is implying that God is the ultimate abuser. He is both good and evil. He knows both good and evil. And of course, if you've never experienced evil before, what is it? How would you know? You see, the problem with Adam and Eve is they had never experienced evil before. Their minds were being played with by the serpent, and they did not know what they were getting into. It was a wholly uncharted path for them. Well, let's look at the consequences. Page 3. The woman saw that the tree was good for food. It had external appeal. And that it was addictive to the eyes. Now, that's my loose translation. It really is that it was desirable to the eyes. But this is addiction. This is the process of addiction. And that the tree was desirable for understanding. She now was capable of becoming controlled and manipulated by external and magical forces. This is the origin of magic. It's when you think that something irrationally has power to make you think differently, be differently, behave differently, give you a better life. She took of its fruit and ate. She submitted to the serpent. And she also gave to her husband with her, and he ate. That's typical of victims of abuse. They tend to want other people to be victims with them. And in the process, she spread her codependency around and created another victim. So she became immediately abusive. The eyes of both of them were opened. Their reality changed. Their perceptions were now clouded. They saw the other side of God they had never seen before. Please keep in mind, this is very crucial to our understanding of abuse. All abuse is rooted and grounded in misconceptions about God. That is the origin of sin. That is the origin of abuse. They're all one. And that the road back then is to gain a clear perception of who God is. The eyes of both of them being opened means they saw something about God they'd never seen before. It wasn't there, but they thought it was. Now, I want to give you a modern illustration of this. You have a friend that you're very fond of, very close to, and somebody comes to you and says, "You think that friend is wonderful? Let me tell you something about your friend." And they begin to tell you things you never wanted to know about your friend. Would you believe them? You might try not to. I know better. I know that friend is not that way. You might try hard, but would you see your friend the same way? One of my students made the comment. He said, "You know, it doesn't matter how hard I try not to believe what I'm told. When someone tells me something bad about someone, I never can look at them quite the same way again." When Adam and Eve's eyes were open, they were in a state of seeing God in a way they had never seen Him before, as oppressive, arbitrary, controlling, abusive. He wasn't that way. He hadn't changed, but their perceptions of Him had. And they became true victims, as if He had been abusive. The abuse took place in their head. And they were incapable of reversing the process once they got on that trajectory, once they believed the serpent. And as a result, they knew they were naked. Now, this is kind of a little bit amusing. Did they just become naked? They'd been naked all along. Doesn't the Bible say that when God created them, He created them naked? They were naked and not ashamed. But now they were naked. They knew that they were naked. What does that mean? I would like to suggest that's symbolic. I think it's literal, but I think it's also symbolic. The abuse leaves its victim stripped of personhood. What Adam and Eve were clothed with was the light from God's presence. It was the embrace of His love. Because that light that came from Him, that glory, was the glory of His love. We could go to Exodus 33:34 for that. The glory of God really is the glory of His love. It embraced them constantly. When they rejected it, when they decided the serpent was right about God, they lost it. They cut themselves off from it. The result is they were naked and ashamed. They were stripped of their personhood, their sense of value, their sense of worth. They had lost it. And so they stitched fig leaves together and made loincloths for themselves. Victims always attempt to compensate. The usual way is excuses. And they heard the voice or the sound of God walking in the garden. Hebrew can be either way. What do you think they heard? I think they heard what they had heard every night before. God maybe singing a song, a love song to them. But now that love song turned into something condemnatory and wrathful because their picture of God had changed. We see other people the way we've been taught to see them. And Adam and Eve's perceptions of God had so changed that when he came the same way he'd come every other evening, they see him now as someone to be terrified of. And so they hid, or they kept themselves hidden from among the garden's trees. They went into denial. They hid from the false perceptions. This is a reaction to belief, that they believed God was abusive. And it says specifically, they hid from the face of the Lord God. Victims typically cannot look into a person's face. They cannot trust. And the Lord God called to the man and said, "Where are you?" And he said, "I heard your voice in the garden, and I was afraid." That fear is now a jump from the frontal lobes to the midbrain. The reasoning powers have shut down. Why? Because they chose to believe that fruit had power to make them wise. That is irrational thinking. Nothing external has power over anybody except as they give it power. And giving it power is becoming a victim of abuse. I had a student who had suffered a lot of abuse in her life from childhood on. And I ended up being in her counselor's office with her one day as her counselor tried to help her sort through some things. And I'll never forget what the counselor told her. She said, "You're used to giving your power away to other people, to letting them control you. Now you need to take that power back. You need to have power over your life to make your own decisions." That is actually very, very true. When Adam and Eve ate that fruit, they gave their power away to the serpent. They were no longer in control. They had allowed something outside of them, external, to control them. And once they believed that God was arbitrary, abusive, they further gave their power away because they thought that to submit to Him meant to submit like they were to an abuser. I'm going to let you read the rest of this, these two pages, for yourselves as you choose in terms of what happens. I want to stop with the fear. This is not quite the end, but it's close to the end. Fear is the hallmark of a victim's response to abuse. Abuse causes fear. If it doesn't, it's not either not abuse, or the person has become abused so long they've gotten hardened to fear, or something's terribly wrong with the person. I've been a victim of abuse, as I mentioned at the beginning, over the past 6 years, almost 6 years. It'll be 6 years in another 2 months. And in my situation, the abuse is intended to create fear. It's a kind of an ongoing terrorist kind of activity. And in that kind of terrorism, a person either learns to go into denial in such a state you just kind of block it out because it lasts so long, or you constantly are on edge. And that fear is a natural response to feeling in danger. Now, the tragedy of this story isn't that Adam and Eve were afraid of something real. The tragedy is that they were afraid of the very person who was their best friend. The person who loved them, who gave them their value, who would ultimately die to save them. They were afraid of a God, and they didn't have any reason to be afraid of Him. They were in a state of paranoia. I'm concerned that the most prevailing and difficult and least known abuse in our society is that of spiritual abuse. And there's a bibliographic reference in your bibliography in this handout that gives you a book that you could read on spiritual abuse. It's very good. Spiritual abuse is creating a picture of God in people's minds and using it as clout over their heads to try to make them obey that creates fear. It is making God out to be an abusive parent, an abusive creator. And I really believe that that is the root foundation of almost every kind of abuse we have in our society. Let me give you a statistical reference. I don't have the exact figures, but I am told by behavioral scientists that the most prevalent cases of sexual and other kinds of abuse exist in the most conservative religious families. Statistically speaking, the most common abusers are those who are the most religious and the most conservatively religious. How can that be? Well, if religion is the way the serpent portrayed it, if God is the person the serpent made him out to be, that explains everything. You see, the road to recovery then is to ask ourselves, is God an abuser? And if he's not, what kind of a God is he? We're going to look tomorrow at who God is. We're going to start in the Old Testament, believe it or not. You may think that's a strange place to begin because most people think of the Old Testament God as a real abusive God. And he gets angry and he kills people and look what he did. He sent the flood and he burned up Sodom and Gomorrah and all those things. We're going to look at him through different eyes. We're actually going to look at him through the Ten Commandments. That may seem even more abusive, depending on how you've come to view the Ten Commandments. But actually, therein lies a key. A key to how to overcome abuse. Now, the Ten Commandments by themselves don't give us that key. But if we view them in Christ, and through the eyes of the New Testament, they become a living document, an actual process by which God can help us overcome abuse in our lives. There's definite hope. I don't want to leave you on a note of, oh my, are we all abusers? The thing I'd like you to remember tonight and the thing I'd like you to process tonight is to think about what makes you valuable. I want you to really think about that for yourself. As you go to bed tonight, ask yourself, am I valuable? Why am I valuable? And remember that you are valuable because God made you in His image. And He loves you even when you can't know that He loves you. He loves you enough to not only make you, but to work to save you. And look what a price He paid to do that. That's how valuable you are. And if you can grasp that concept, the rest of the road will be comparatively easy. I can't stress that enough. I had a gentleman after a Bible class a few weeks ago come up to me and he said, what you haven't talked about is how can we know if we love God? And I probed him a little bit and I said, does God love you? Do you believe that God loves you? He said, well, I think He does. He said, He told me He did in church. He whispered in my ear, right here in this ear. He whispered, I love you. Now, it could have been the devil. I said, oh, so you hope He loves you. You think He might possibly love you, but you don't believe He loves you. You see, that's our problem. Most of us hope God is nice. Most of us think He might be. Most of us think He might love us. At least we know He loves the world, and we fit in there somehow. But we don't believe. We believe that He loves us and values us. That's what I'd like you to work on tonight. Is work on, am I valuable to God? And settle that question in your mind. Now, you may not do it in one night. And you'll understand better why. That whole process isn't something you can learn and memorize for a test. That process is something you have to experience. So if you can't find out whether God loves you tonight and whether He values you and whether you're worth a lot to Him, ask Him to help you experience His love, personally and really, And as he answers that prayer, and he will if you let him, that is, if you ask, then as you let him love you, the rest will be in God's hands. We make it so hard. We make it so complicated. We talk about grace as though it's something God siphons off from heaven and by pipette or something and gives us a drop here and there. You know, we were born in grace. We were created in grace. Did Adam and Eve earn their keep in the Garden of Eden? Did they do anything to merit their life? Did they earn the right to eat of the tree of life? It was all grace. God created that beautiful garden, handed the keys to his firstborn son, and said, it's all yours. You can do with it what you want to. And look what we've done with it. Would you, as a loving parent, get your son a new Ferrari, give him the keys, last second barrel, sign over the title, hand it to him, and he's out the door, and a few minutes later you get a call from the police department, your son's been in an accident. He's down here at the police station, can you come pick him up? You go down there, new Ferrari, smashed total. God, your son's still alive. Would you go home, buy him another Ferrari, hand it to him and say, here are the keys? Is that what God did? He gave us that beautiful garden. We messed it up royally. We destroyed it. We made it in, well, not the garden maybe, but this world. And then what did he do but give us his son? And look what we did with him. We treated him just like we have this planet. Does God stop at that and say, well, if you're going to treat my son that way, forget you. He wants to give us that garden back with all eternity to enjoy. Is that grace? See, God has never been anything but gracious. We've never needed to earn anything. Our value has never been something we had to merit or achieve. It was already given to us from day one. We've always been in the state of grace. We fell away from that by believing Satan's lies. God is working to bring us back into it. Our whole mad-driven work ethic is in the wrong model. And the next two sessions, I hope can move us from that model to where God really wants us. It's late, but maybe we could have a little bit of time for a few questions. I know I've given you a heavy dose.
Well, you say that all abuse is spiritual abuse. You think that the abuser, like you're saying, that it comes from the one you can have God to like the all abuser. So you think the person, like I lived next door to neighbors once in Pennsylvania, the walls were just real thin, and he was constantly abusing his wife. But this man had no concept of God in his life, and it's for men. So
he had a concept, though, of a big person on top. That is, maybe it was his father. But somebody bigger than he. And one of the things I failed to point out to you, so I'm glad you raised that question, is that all abusers were once victims themselves. In the cycle of abuse, the cycle of abuse works this way. And if you look at that first page again, the victim moves down from low self-esteem to conformity. And once he reaches conformity, he becomes the next abuser. I believe it's 30% in behavioral science studies, 30% of victims become abusers. But every abused victim is at risk to become an abuser, given the opportunity, pushed beyond endurance, put in a situation that recalls everything they've experienced. There's a reason for that. The Bible teaches us that by beholding, we become changed. We become like what we worship and admire, whatever that is. If our parents have abused us, we're at higher risk than to abuse someone else. So victims are first victims and then they become abusers. So your friend, your next door neighbor, was he raised at all in a religious home? You see, it's possible that he was, but at any rate, the key is still the same. To give him a new concept of God, a concept he maybe never had. It's true that some people maybe never heard of God. That's hard to believe in our society that they could live without. But I imagine there are some who could. But most people are without God because they rejected a God who would be so abusive. And they may not indicate that. It may be so long ago they did that we don't see it. But at any rate, the cure is still the same. Because their picture of supreme power, their picture of authority, their picture of whatever would make up God is still that of an abuser.
I don't know if I heard you correctly, and I don't know if you remember exactly what you said before, but I think you said something to the effect of the root of abuse is this conception of God's character. Did you say, can you explain that a little bit again, or are you going to go more detail?
No, I may have to wait till tomorrow because the answer to that question involves some concepts that we haven't dealt with yet, that we will be dealing with tomorrow. Again, we are human beings that have intelligence, both emotional intelligence and logical intelligence, rational intelligence. And as a result, we aren't objects that can easily just be manipulated or told what to do. We have to be, we're developmental human beings. And consequently, our whole development is shaped by our perception of what authority is, our perception of what power is, our perception of how reality works, whether we believe in God or not.
So it's actually...
It is spiritual.
If I'm understanding you correctly, we're incapable of grasping this concept unless more of our brain is developed in that particular area.
Well, or to put it another way, unless we have experienced it. And you can experience it at any age.
It's almost a physical grasping, in the sense of how your brain grasps it, as well as an intuitive experience. In other words, it's not just a...
I see it as both experiential and rational. And the better those two work together, the more quickly we can grasp it. But of course, usually in cases of abuse, one part of the brain has been more damaged than the other. So you can't equally use both sides. So you have to work with first the side of the brain that's capable of dealing with it.
It may not be so for you, but you know, you brought up the Catholic Church, it was so huge and so disturbing to me. I can tell you what you said, how it relates, but I can't get there.
Well, for one thing, I've given you an awful lot to assimilate. An awful lot of stuff you've never heard before. So that alone, you have to live with it a while before you start understanding something. It's like learning a new language. And basically, I've given you a new language. But the other thing is that I've only given you the left side of the brain tonight. The other part is experience. And we're going to begin working on that starting tomorrow afternoon. Because everything is uphill from here. We've gotten to our lowest point. Everything is going to get better from this point on because we'll be talking about the solutions. And the solutions are in a conceptual world that we don't tend to deal with in religious terms. We don't even tend to think it's religious. But it really is. It's very biblical. And I can't wait to share it because once you begin to see that open up, I think you'll get some aha moments like, oh, that's what I've been missing. It was something that basically the student I mentioned taught me. It's a key. Maybe I should say it tonight so you can muse on it and get ready for it tomorrow. The key is that we love, this is 1 John 4:19, we love because he first loved us. That's the key. Because love can only be experienced. It cannot be rationally taught. So we can only love if someone has first loved us. Initially, that is intended to be our parents who stand in the place of God to us. If our parents let us down, then we have to find other parents. Ultimately, all of us are in need of getting linked into the source of love. Because God is the only person who doesn't have to be loved in order to love us. Therefore, he can love us perfectly. How does he do that? Well, we'll be talking about that tomorrow. But that's the key. In fact, that verse, 1 John 4:19, happens to be my favorite verse in the Bible. I use it over much in my teaching because it encapsulates to me a major natural law that God has created, natural spiritual law that he has created, that we are incapable of loving without having been loved. And we can only love to the extent that we are loved. So if a person, this is what gets me about us Christians, we're always talking about how we ought to love God. We've got to love God. And I used to shrivel up inside because I tried so hard to love God and I couldn't. And then one day I found out God loved me. And it changed everything in my life. I had no trouble loving God once I experienced His love. But that's a law. You can't make yourself love someone until you have been loved. And particularly God, who is the source of love, can't love Him until you have experienced His love for you. That's why I said what I did to the gentleman who is struggling with this. How do I know I love God? Well, how do you know God loves you? That's the problem. He didn't believe God loved him. Though he believed that and began to experience it, he couldn't love God. No way in the world could he love God. But we put an awful lot of guilt and burdens on people when we tell them they have to love God, and we create all kinds of mechanisms by which we make them think they can love God. If you do this, then you love him. And if you do that. Anybody here seen Fiddler on the Roof? Remember the scene? Remember the scene where he has just found out that their next oldest daughter is going to get married? And the reason is because we love each other. Remember? And he comes in to tell his wife, Golda, who doesn't want to know this, and started asking her, "Do you love me? Do I love you? I've washed your dishes and I've made your bed and I've, you know, done cooked your meals," and she gives him this huge list. "Of course I love you. But do you love me?" And he goes on, and this, those of you who've seen this, remember that finally they sit down. "Well, I guess I do. Well, it's kind of nice to know." I mean, and you can see the terrible distorted picture of what love is. If I slave for you, I love you. Or if I do all the things you want me to do, I love you. That isn't love. But that's the kind of legalism we all have fallen into. And by the way, abuse is legalism, and legalism is abuse. We're all guilty. There isn't a single non-legalist in society. Whether they're a Christian or not, they're legalists. It's only by the grace of God that we can ever move out of that and move to a trusting, healthy, whole relationship with God. Otherwise, we're always caught in this trap of trying to make ourselves valuable and imagine that we're valuable because of what we do, or that we love God because of what we do. Any other questions? Yes.
Did you say only 30% of victims turn into abusers? That's all?
That's the measurable result. How much of that is not measurable? Personally, of course, I've already stated my position tonight. I don't want to frighten people, but I think we're all abusers and all abused. That any time we mistreat another person, we've abused them. And any time we're mistreated, we've been abused. We're all caught up in this cycle. It's inescapable. And once a person realizes, I've done this part of the seminar and had people come up to me and say, "Is there any hope for me?" Or, "I'm not an abuser. I don't really think I've been, and I'm like, "Well, you know, get rid of your pride here." We all are. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. So we all are. There's some of us who have been extensively more abused than others. Some of us have only tasted it compared to others. So there's all of the whole spectrum of abuse. And the stories that I draw from are from the upper end of that spectrum, like Dave Peltzer's book. That's certainly the upper end of abuse. So I wouldn't want to minimize those stories of horror that I've experienced. But until all of us realize that, we're going to go on being abusers and hurting people. And that's, I know I'm in that category. I can tell you, in fact, I was going to use as an illustration tonight, one of the stories that I hate about myself the most. Jesus said, if you offend one of these little ones, it'd be better if a millstone be hung around your neck and you'd be cast into the sea. Well, I offended a little one time that I really wish I could have had a millstone around my neck and been thrown in. She was a little girl who lived back of us, and we'd take her to Big Asian Bible School, and she sat in the front seat of the car with me. I was in college, and I was helping out my mom in this whole vacation Bible school. And she got a little rough with me one morning, and I decided to use some discipline. I didn't realize what I was doing to her. I grabbed her by the wrist and hung on for dear life. She wiggled, twisted, tried to get out, began to complain about pain. I hung on. I wouldn't let go. We got to the church where we were having the vacation Bible school. I got out of the car. I tried to sit near her. She scooted down the aisle and wouldn't have anything to do with me and wouldn't get near me. I realized I had broken her trust. That may seem like a mild case, but do you know what you do to a child when you do that kind of thing? You basically exercise might and power over them. They're not equal to your strength. So you're controlling them, absolutely. There's no two-way street. And several weeks went by, and I tried to forget about it, and God didn't let me. He kept on me. And one morning while I was doing dishes, he got to me. And I stopped in the middle of doing dishes, walked around the block to her house, and knocked on the door. And I hoped she was the one that would answer the door. In fact, I was praying she would be the one, because I didn't want to have to be embarrassed in front of her family to have to confess my sin to her. Well, her older brother opened the door. And I asked to see her, and he called her out. And as soon as she saw me, she ran to the drape, buried her face in it, and all I could see was her hand. Because she buried her whole body in it. And as she stood there, I began to relate what I had done. I didn't know what else to do. I reminded her of the occasion, told her what I did, and then I said, you know, I came to tell you I'm sorry, because Jesus would never treat you like that. I misrepresented Jesus to you, and I hope you never think that he is like I was that morning. And I'll never forget, her hand had been clutching the drape till her knuckles were absolutely white. And when I told her I was sorry, and that I had misrepresented Jesus to her, that Jesus would never treat her that way, I saw her hand relax. She never would look at me. She was a true victim of my own displeasure. But I know I have that capacity in me to abuse. And I know I'm as abusive as the next person. I have suffered my share of abuse. And I know exactly what this trajectory can lead a person to become. I wrestle with that every day of my life. If you get frightened enough, thoroughly enough, long enough, and feel powerless long enough, you tend to go that trajectory without healing from above. So I'm not exactly, I haven't arrived and I haven't gotten all the answers. I'm still looking. But you'll hear as far as I've gotten in the next few sessions. And what I have come to understand, to me, has totally transformed the way I think about God and the way I do theology. I'm no longer this ivory tower theologian just up there just disseminating knowledge. I see it as life. And it has to do with how we live and how we see God. And that's very real. And I think it has the greatest power of all to change us in the way we do things and how we see other people and ourselves. So, again, go home and think about how valuable you are to God. Let's pray. Dear God, I pray that we may be able to get off this terrible cycle of abuse that we are all caught up in. Some of us more than others. That we may come to see you not as we have mistakenly believed you to be, but as you have been revealed in your Son, Jesus Christ. May we come to have a trusting relationship with you. May we come to see our value and know our worth in you. May it transform our lives. In Jesus' name, amen.